Joe, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. Well, tonight we wanted to talk about the mysterious occulted banking system, the alchemy of finance, as George Soros calls it. So, yeah. Is it alchemy? Have they found the philosopher's stone? Can they convert base metal into gold and the miracle of getting rid of a scarcity? What does the banking system do? What is it all about? What are we dealing with here? I think it was Henry Ford who was quoted as saying, "It is well enough that the people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system, for if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning." So, what do you make of our wonderful banking system, this engine of growth and dynamism and creativity, this financial sector, Wall Street, and the bankers, or how they provide capital to small business and us little people to live the American dream, buy a house, buy a car, get a college education, buy a flat screen TV set.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, basically the banking system, the Federal Reserve System in the United States and in Western civilization, is a slave system. It has one product, which is totalitarianism. And by that, I mean, you know, basically one world government, one world owned by the individuals who own the banking system. And that's really what it's designed to do, as best I can make out. The Federal Reserve, I mean, people talk about the name Federal Reserve and that it's obviously mind control, because the Federal Reserve is in fact a corporation that is owned by what is referred to as the primary banks. And these are the big banks. These are the banks that were, in one way or another, had their influence present at the creation of the Federal Reserve System by Woodrow Wilson in, I believe it was 1913. Edward Griffin has written a great book called Creature from Jekyll Island that, you know, goes through the process by which the banking system was created. And he points out that it was completely done in secrecy, right? There was like the atomic bomb. There's no participation by democracy in the actual creation of the entity. The people who got together, they were representing the large banking families. The banks, to a large extent, were all represented there. And these banking families, you know, are all interrelated. The Warburgs, the Kuhns, the Loebs, the Rothschilds, the Schiffs, the Jewish side of it, and they make up the large fraction. They, if you look at the board of directors of these banks, you can see these names pop up over and over again. And in the marriage and the interfamily relationships, it's just one big family clump, which is actually pretty well easy to understand and document. It's not that particular occulted aspect that this is just a group of families. It's not really that hard, even though it's seldom mentioned for some reason. But there was something that happened that Griffin points out that was really important, is that in this era, everyone was worried about monopoly, right? This was a huge problem. People could see this in all these industries, that these monopolies were being set up. And so the public responded by trying to elect individuals who would fight against these monopolies, which were called trusts. Trusts.
Trust busters, right?
Yes, and the trust busters would be the ones that would go in and break them up. And basically, they were called trust because these things are cartels, in effect. In other words, these are agreements between corporations, businesses, individuals, which get rid of competition so that, you know, there would be, you know, an agreement in terms of, well, I won't come into your region, you won't come into mine, I won't make this widget, you won't make that gadget. You know, there would just be different ways to get rid of competition that would be to the benefit of the people who are inside the cartel and, of course, to the detriment of those who are participating in the buying of the products of the cartel. And if they get big enough, you know, like the oil cartel, where there's really basically, you know, monopoly, then they are just impossible to, you know, control because they can set their own prices. So they were called trust because that was what went on between the individuals inside these cartels, is their trust of one another, you know. And so trust busters were in vogue, and in fact, Woodrow Wilson, amazingly, was you know, seen as someone who might be a trust buster, but in fact, he was a cartel creator. But anyway, the point is that at Jekyll Island, where they met in secrecy to create the Federal Reserve, these individuals were actually supposedly all in competition. So as has been pointed out, the very basis of the meeting was illegal because, you know, there was supposed to be competition between the banks. And in fact, when you get together to create this kind of agreed upon structure without any democratic participation, you're going to end up with basically what is a monopoly. And man, did that happen here. So this is the first, you know, point, is that the public, it was occulted, you know, the topic we're talking about, is that the public had no participation in it. There was an article written years later by one of the members, Frank Vandalep, I believe his name is. I forget how.
Vandalep, yeah.
Yeah, so he wrote an article about it, and I think in the Saturday Post or something. And he described what happened, how secret it was, how they used fake names. You know, there was all these really bizarre kind of ways to avoid any sort of public scrutiny of the thing.
Yeah, it was supposedly a duck hunting trip or something.
Yeah, it was a duck hunting trip to this private island. And the reason that, you know, they gave is that there'd been a banking panic in 07. Now, what this means is that banks had lent out far more than they had taken in. The public panic, tried to get their money out, and the banks don't have any money. And so the idea was is that, well, we can sell the public on the idea there being a lender of last resort. Mm-hmm. That would be the Federal Reserve, right?
And supposedly so that panic was precipitated by a whisper campaign started by one J.P. Yeah. Morgan, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, if you go through this, they've been trying to get this thing passed for years. I mean, basically since the founding of the country. I mean, it was a huge battle at the very beginning about whether or not the private banks could become the national bank. Hamilton was fighting against basically everyone to get this done. He eventually succeeded. And then up to, I think it's 1823, there was a national bank. In other words, that was more or less a pure Rothschild event.
Yeah, I think its charter expired, wasn't renewed.
Yeah, Jackson would renew the charter, and then for about 90 years there was no federal bank. The U.S. Treasury functioned as the creator of dollars. Anyway, so
incidentally, under the independent treasury system as it became to be known, the federal government actually paid off its debt.
Well, sure. I mean, because I'm sure we're going to get into this, but I mean, the whole way that the government is able to function, U.S. government is able to function with wars everywhere and all these welfare programs, is because of the Federal Reserve, because of what's called the open market operation. Now, you know, like the Federal Reserve is, is not something that is either federal or has any reserves, really, though it does actually have quite a bit of – it has a huge balance sheet. But the fact is that it has this process which it calls the open market operation, and everyone should really know about how this operates and stuff. And so I think we should go through it just a little bit, if you don't mind. I mean, it's a little boring, but the open.
Well, one thing I want to mention before you get into that is
the
Federal Reserve Act itself was, the original bill was sponsored by one Nelson Aldrich, a Republican senator from Rhode Island, I believe, whose daughter married John D. Rockefeller II.
Yeah.
And so this is another example talking about these familial relations, how they marry into the, how political families marry into these elite, banking families. And so, but I think what happened was, to make it seem like it was a reform bill, they got, was it Carter Glass to sponsor the bill?
Yeah, Glass. Yeah.
Yeah. So actually the official, but it really was a Republican bill, a banking reform bill, as it was.
Yeah.
So another example of how they marry into these political families. And of course, Nelson Rockefeller, the famed governor of New York, one who cast such a long shadow throughout the 1970s, throughout the 20th century, dying in the late 1970s. He was named after Nelson Aldrich. He was
I think it wasn't Aldrich's grandfather?
Yeah, he was. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, I mean, it's just one big sick clump of, inbred families. How to unparse this for people? Because, I talk to people all the time. I'm a big talker, Tim. I'm on the phone. People Skype me. I don't get invited to parties, but I'm high demand to talk to you for some reason. Anyway, I always try to get, some sense as to what people understand about the finance, because it's such an important part. And it's amazing to me, even really sophisticated people who understand far more details than I ever could about, political machinations, secret society, different aspects of simple things about finance they just don't have a clue about. And so I think it's useful for people to know, particularly the one real con job theft that goes on basically every day that the Federal Reserve engages in. And it camouflages it by calling it the open market operation. Now, there's two things that this is not. One is open and the other is a market. So the way it works is that, the Treasury creates bonds. Now, the Treasury doesn't actually sell the bonds. They deliver them to bond dealers. These are typically primary banks themselves, right? Okay. So like, if you're like Goldman Sachs, you're a bond dealer, that you get the bond and you're told to sell it. Now, you're paid for this. Now, why the government does this, of course, is beyond me. But anyway, they do. So they auction them off. Now, so if the Fed decides that it says it wants to expand the money supply, here's where the alchemy, you talk a lot, you use the expression a lot, the financial alchemy, right? Well, here's the alchemy. So the Fed says, it's time to expand the old money supply, which basically means no one will want to buy the Treasury bonds, and so the Fed's going to have to step in. But it says it's going to expand the money supply. So it buys the bonds from the dealer. Now, bear in mind, the dealers are typically just itself, right? It's just like, because the Federal Reserve, just to back up a second, the Federal Reserve is a corporation. Basically, all banks in the Federal Reserve system own shares in it. Since we can't audit the thing, no one knows the fraction of ownership, but it is well understood that the primary banks hold the voting control, right? So when and the primary banks are the bond sellers. They're the people that the Treasury issues the bonds to. They then auction them off typically to themselves. Mm-hmm. And the Fed says, okay, we want to expand the money supply. And so it decides that it will step in and buy the bonds, right? So this is really quite, alchemistic, because the Treasury is claiming that it wants to expand the money supply, and therefore it's going to buy the bonds from itself. Where does the Fed get the money? Well, this is where the alchemy is. The money just created. So now the Fed buys the bonds, and it puts them into what it's called its balance sheet, or it's basically it reserves. Now, the bank that the banks then are able to use the bonds that the Federal Reserve holds as reserves. Now, this is very complicated, and we're not going to spend a lot of time with it, and people don't really need to understand this, other than to really see that the interest is now being increased. In other words, they're going to be paying more than the Treasury created the note for. Say the Treasury creates it for two, and now the reserves are basically a debt to the bank that is claiming them as a reserve. The bank is basically swapping money that has come in as deposits, and now has given that money to the Fed. And the Fed needs even way more money than this, because remember, it's also going to be buying bonds as well. So this is when it expands the money supply, is when the Federal Reserve actually basically will buy bonds in the open market that the other banks don't want. And so it'll buy them. All of this stuff ends up in what's called the Federal Reserve balance sheet, which is now at around just under $5 trillion. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So now...
I think as recently as 2008, it was only $800 billion.
It was $800 billion, yeah. So they've expanded the money supply.
Four times.
Now even the phrase expanded the money supply is just completely a lie, because, Tim, there is hardly any more money in circulation now than there was back in 08. Mm-hmm. What there is, I mean, because the Fed has sequestered all of this cash, the banks don't need to basically loan out much money, because in the 08 law, there was a change made which indicated that the banks could retain the interest. So the banks are now simply arbitraging. They're just buying the, they buy at one price, and the Treasury then will pay them more for the face value of the note than they had to cough up for the thing.
This is the carry trade.
It's a carry trade, right? And so they're carry trading basically the taxpayer, because at the end of the day, the taxpayer has to pick up all of this stuff. This all is going to end up in our lap one way or another.
And it's pure financialization, because there's no goods and services being produced in these transactions.
Zero, absolutely not. And then beyond that, now you have the fractional reserve stuff, where because the banks have been able to acquire reserves.
Oh, Joe, can I interject one thing here?
Sure.
A little bit of history is that you mentioned the Open Market Committee.
And yeah.
When the Federal Reserve Act was first passed, this is a good example of mission creep. I don't think it was just accidental or coincidental, history unfolding, as we say, is the way it was established was the Fed was there to provide an elastic money supply to deal with panics, lender of last resort. And the way that was done was the Fed would provide liquidity based on existing corporate paper. And so there was a theoretical limitation on what they could, how much money they could create and contract when appropriate to deal with these occasional panics, like the 1907 Knickerbocker trust collapse, these things.
Yes, yep.
This was how it was, so to the extent that the public was aware of this, and this is how it was rationalized to deal with these panics. And so it was relatively limited in its mission at that time, like anything else, it expands. But, darn it, along came the war. And they can never tax enough to pay for the war, because then no one will want to fight the war. They need to inflate, debase the money supply. And all the U.S. government, although technically stayed on the gold standard during World War I, it really debased the money supply. How it did that was through this expansion of the Open Market Committee, where the Fed stepped in and monetized debt, the process through which you're talking about, to deal with the emergency, because if they weren't allowed to do this, the Kaiser was going to rape all our women. So
right, exactly right.
And then it was off for the races. So
right, well, so, yeah. when it okay, so that's always there's always incrementalism
yes.
in this stuff. And so when it cut, when the Federal Reserve was created, it was supposedly sold to the public as a way to stop banking panics. So mm-hmm. what happened was in 07, banks were failing. J.P. Morgan, who had the most corporate paper, basically, and therefore had access to capital the way that that system worked, he said, okay, I'm going to fund this bank, I'm going to fund that bank. He would basically step in overnight, and in some cases, he would give them like $10 million. And then Rockefeller was also there. Mm-hmm. He would give one bank, he basically, you know, said, I'll just cover the debt. And so then these panics, the idea was, is we needed to organize how the large solvent banks could basically prop up weak banks during these panics, which were seen as basically irrational because, you know, in the long run, the banks were operating prudently and most of them would not fail, though some did. But, you know, you wanted to have like you said, basically what it was originally was just the Federal Reserve had the capacity to issue credit, was going to have the capacity to issue credit based on some formula, which I don't understand. I'd like to see that, actually.
Well, I think the idea was you have corporate paper, which is a reflection of goods and services, and they would provide immediate liquidity. So it wasn't...
It was liquidity, but I'm just wondering, like, was it fractional in its nature? I think it was two times what they could. I could be wrong about that. But it was twice what the corporate paper was. They could actually create credit short term, and this would, like, you know, basically patch things up till the panic subsided.
Yeah, because ultimately the panics are brought about by reckless lending or being overextended, which is all.
Yeah, but then goes back then to you're actually right. Then the war occurred, and now it's just off to the races. And so then the next thing was, well, the panic was in the National Treasury because the warmongers wanted to slaughter Germans and they didn't have enough money. And so the idea was, is that the open market operation could exist and they could expand the money supply, in other words, invent money. And then, the hope was, is that this debt could then be reduced in the future because they could tax more and have more profitable eras and so that they could, you know, get through this crisis, and just so that the crisis was the justification.
By the way, I think we're still paying off the World War I war debt. So
yeah, we'll never pay. Right.
that's the formula.
Yeah. So anyway, then when so now when you get to, you know, the present era, you have you know, there's been an amazing transformation, because if you look back at 08, which really, I think, exposed the alchemy, you had, the lender of last resort was actually borrowing money from the U.S. government, because the Treasury basically stepped in. In with the $700 billion financial rescue package that was signed into law in one day, basically. But it helped the Federal Reserve basically become the owner of, or fill in the debt for, like, AIG and Lehman. So what you have is supposedly the lender of last resort became a borrower from the Treasury to basically buy Lehman, or to fill in the debt, and then also the $85 billion loan to AIG, where it becomes an 80% owner. And now here you've had a complete collapse of the whole, all of the cover story is broken down, and you can see the system is just faked, because the Treasury Department was now selling bonds instead of the primary dealer. But the money wasn't going to go to the government. It was going to go to the Federal Reserve to help the central bank deal with its unprecedented borrowing needs. Mm-hmm. So you now have, the system is exposed as being sort of silly. But the point I wanted to make, and let me be long-winded, is that the open market operation is just... is a criminal act, and it's if people just have their heads right, they can see it. Because the first thing is, the Treasury should not have to go through intermediaries that it will pay interest to borrow money. I mean, why does it need to do that? You see, I mean, this just makes absolutely no sense at all. The Treasury should simply issue the money to whoever needs the money that is reasonable. And then if there's going to be interest, it should be paid directly back to the Treasury. Shouldn't be paid, because the way it is now, the markup on the interest that gets to the public is larger, far larger than the actual interest that the Treasury charges to the primary banks. Mm-hmm. So why in this process are the primary banks, who have no capital risk, they're able to buy these bonds with money they don't have for nothing, right? Basically, they have no cash in the bank. The Fed invents the money, they end up with these notes, and then they can resell them and lend out to the public at these very higher interest rates. So basically, what you're really looking at is the alchemy of usury. Mm-hmm. Right? This is really what we're dealing with, is that they're able to create a process that's confusing. And that's the only reason it exists, is just to confuse people, that they think it's reasonable to get like an 8% credit card debt, interest debt. But the fact is, it's not. There's nothing reasonable about it whatsoever. It's just frankly insane. There is no reason why we would want to have these people stand between the individual who needs the money and the Treasury. If the Federal Reserve was simply a federal agency, the government should simply issue its tender directly, right? Mm-hmm. You have this the need to have interest-bearing debt to the private middlemen, who they're the ones who create the money out of thin air, right? So a really Federal Reserve system would lend simply on the faith of credit the United States, whatever that's worth, and it would lend to the states and local governments interest-free, and this would cost the whole the cost of the debt structure by more than half, right? This would be a direct capital investment into the local economies, direct, because all of the debt of the interest wouldn't have to, you could dramatically reduce it. So anyway, folks, we've been had. This is why the whole thing was done in secret. This is why the incrementalism, this is why there's never any audit of the thing. If it gets audited, there won't be any laws broken. They've made all the laws basically to protect themselves. But what will happen is people will start to just realize, wait a second, the whole thing is a scam.
Yeah, that's talk about the system. What's worse about the system is what is legal. I think it was Frederick Bastiat who said, when plunder becomes a way of life for a group of men living together in society, they create for themselves in the course of time a legal system that authorizes it and a moral code that glorifies it. And boy, aren't we living under that today?
Yeah.
And it's what's legal, technically legal within the banking system, is what is most criminal. Why all this debt? Why interest? Well, that's the answer, because debt, usury is a method of enslavement, and that's why it's imposed. Look at how the system was designed from the get-go, it was there to constantly roll over debt to keep it perpetual. And you look at something like fractional reserve, we talk about what's illegal. I mean, we do euphemisms and you try to make the system as arcane, as complicated as possible, so the common man simply says, well, it's above my pay grade. I mean, for the experts to talk about. But something like fractional reserve banking, which is just a euphemism for banking fraud.
Yeah.
Or conversion, right? Criminal conversion. We take a deposit, you turn it into a loan. That's what's called conversion. We have a system now which converts deposits into loans and loans into deposits, and the deposits back in loans again, and so on and so on. And this is how you get this huge monetary expansion. But the bottom line is every dollar is debt. Every dollar that's created is more debt. So
In general, they create reserves based on deposits. Mm-hmm. Right? The reserves are held, but they no longer have to keep them at the own bank. They can basically give the money to the Federal Reserve, who then has this little magic box where it says, okay, we got this much, you know, bonds we're holding for the Bank X. And we're also going to pay the interest to Bank X on this. So the Bank X is making an arbitrage on the original money that was lent up by the Treasury. But then Bank X goes out and lends 10 times that amount. It's entitled to lend out 10 times the amount of the reserves and get interest on all of that. Well, now you're getting basically the close to the amount of money that was deposited, which is now being coming to the bank as an annual return from people who are having money that was invented out of thin air by this whole system. And so it's now this is a, as I said, it's a slave system, because the interest that is being sucked up by the banking families is has no function in the in terms of like our real economy other than to create wealth for the owners of these banks. I mean, nothing is happening other than these ledger main activities where credit is created out of thin air. It's lent out. The poor person then has to pay back money. This money then goes back into the banks, who now can lend out 10 times that amount. And it's, but how does this stimulate the economy? What is the purpose of this? You know, and so now one thing I was going to mention is that the Federal Reserve is entitled to actually make a profit. A lot of people think that the Federal Reserve is just kind of a, you know, it's just sort of a gatekeeper and doesn't really operate as a business. But actually, that's not true. The Federal Reserve is able to pay for its operating expenses and a 6% return. Now, as people have wondered, what is the 6% on? What is it a return of what business activity are they referring to? See, this is where an audit would actually be useful, because no one knows what that is. Now, beyond the 6%, it will give whatever is left to the federal government, to Treasury. Mm-hmm. And it has given up to $150 billion a year. So you can see that we're talking gigantic sums.
Yeah, I mean, you have a system where private banks have gone into collusion with the government. And the deal is the government provides this private banking institution, this cartel, a privilege, a monopoly on money creation. In return, this cartel will monetize government debt, and then they both service each other. Because ultimately, the government is actually a tool of the corporations, which ultimately are run by a few families, which own the central banks, which then ultimately control the Bank of International Settlements.
Yeah.
You know.
And so the Fed, now, just to, so I want to just to finally, last little thing here on how the open market stuff. There is a thing called the Fed fund rate. Now, this is a critical, like the open market, this is something people should understand. That rate is a rate that the Federal Reserve creates, right? It creates. It's not the government number. It creates a number that says, we're going to loan money at this amount. Okay. Now, it then can, when it creates the money, the financial institutions, which is itself, right? Because remember, it creates the Fed fund rate, and the primary beneficiary of the Fed fund rate are the primary banks. So when the Federal Reserve says, okay, the Fed fund rate is going to be 1.5%, that isn't a number that any ordinary bank can get at. You have to be a special bank. These banks can get it, and now they can then turn around with their money and they can buy the treasuries. The treasury rate is different than the Fed fund rates. And this is something that a lot of people don't understand, is there is an immediate arbitrage that the Fed says, we're going to invent money at 2%. The treasury says has its 30 year at like say 3%. That 1% is the alchemy. When you talk about the alchemy of, you know, financial control and how money and debt, this is the primary aspect of the alchemy. Is just the arbitrage between what they will sell to themselves money at, credit at, and the amount that then the other people, including the federal government, will pay for debt. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Fed fund rate is the critical aspect that needs to be understood in terms of how the open market operation steals money. And now, how does this, and you have to wonder, well, how does this whole system actually work? Because it's so obviously stealing. Isn't there, aren't they going to run out of money to steal? No, because what they do is when they invent more money, the ultimate victim of all of this is the currency itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's why gold was $35 in 1930, and it's, you know, $1,300 now.
It will be more, and it will be more or less for the efforts of J.P. Morgan. And
you know, if it wasn't for the all of the, yeah, the way they keep it down, but it's
paper,
just like
they have paper gold now.
Paper, yeah. But it's like, look at a home. I mean, a home was like, yes, $8,000. Now it's $800,000. Well, there it is. Mm-hmm. So that's why there is still money left to steal, because they have simply debased. This is where the effect of the theft is felt, is in the currency. Because if they were just stealing the money, they would have stolen everything years ago. And this is also the same process that funds the wars, mm-hmm, and funds the welfare state, is that they, because they're able to debase the currency, they can just keep the thing going as long as people will respect the currency. Ultimately, the way the Federal Reserve systems end is with a collapse of the currency.
Yeah, why ultimately this is a like I think Catherine Austin Fitz says, this is ultimately a military question. It's,
yeah,
this, but the whole, you know, petrodollar system, the fact Bretton Woods, it's backed up by force, and that's why any country which challenges the petrodollar system or the U.S. dollar's role as a world reserve currency is immediately overthrown, like Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi, even token resistance. Right now, China and Russia are trying to work outside the Anglo-American system, outside the dollarized system, and they're trying to set up, you know, infrastructure and trade. And this is why China's probably more controlled than Russia, although Russia has been infiltrated. You know, its banking system is apparently controlled by, you know, Anglo-American Zio interests. But, you know, its government, apparently, there's almost like an internal struggle there between Russian nationalists and, you know, Freemasonic agents. That's the history of Russia the past, you know, several hundred years. So that's why it's so important that the dollar be imposed, because this entire system that you're designing, I mean, you're asking, why wouldn't all this inflation, all this money creation, why isn't there a run on the dollar? It's because ultimately, if you attempt to run on the dollar, you get bombed.
So. Yeah. Right, and they take away all the psychological clues that would otherwise be visible to the sheeple or the normie, you know, as we call them, like the value of gold. You know, people wonder, like Bitcoin, they, well, how can Bitcoin be $10,000?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's because it's very hard for the governments to control it.
Mm-hmm.
They control the price of gold just by selling, you know, $3 or $4 billion of gold contracts into the market in 1 second. And knocking out all the buy bids.
Yeah.
And the price collapses, and they just do this over and over again, and they create a psychological condition. Because remember, ultimately, and I love the expression that you use, alchemy, because it really is alchemy. I mean, ultimately what we're dealing with here is magic and faith. The dollar is basically a religion. And
yeah,
as long as people believe in it, it doesn't matter, you know, that there are 10 trillion gazillion dollars out there. If you believe in the dollar and think a dollar is worth something, by God, it's going to be worth something. Mm-hmm. And that's so how a faith-based system works. It is a religion. However, it has, like all religions, it has a problem in that faith is something that can be lost. And there's nothing really to back it up. And like you say, well, it's a military question. I think we're going to get to see here, you know, at some point pretty quick, you know, to what extent we can actually force people to accept the dollar. Because in my opinion, and I, you know, do try to understand this, and I only have an opinion, but it is this, that it is going to collapse here pretty quick, that there are just too many people wanting out of the dollar system at this point. Too many people are afraid of it. They can see that basically the U.S. is going to have to, you know, cannot really, through its economy, pay for all of its debt. And so it's going to have to massively increase the amount of money it invents for government to use.
Yeah, ask yourself, how can a government that has a $22 trillion deficit have its currency be the world's reserve currency? And it has to be, you know, it's a military question. It's obviously not economic. Because if it was simple economics, it would have collapsed long ago, or the government would have retrenched long ago, been more responsible.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and so, and I'll tell you, the world would be better off because the wars are funded through this system.
Yeah.
And you couldn't create the capital needed to keep all the wars and military bases and militarism and technical innovation and research that's going on that the oligarchs require for their warfare if it was actually economically based. There just isn't enough money in our economy to accomplish that. So if the dollar collapses, you're going to see an absolutely different world because the alchemy will be, you know, done away with, and all that will be left is reality, and the U.S. will be a very poor country, and that won't be able to afford to carry on like it does.
Yeah, and ultimately, it probably depends, and a collapse could be engineered because this the handful of families that own these banks might just determine that, okay, we've sucked the U.S. dry, it's now an empty husk, we'll move on, you know, like the vipers of Venice always do. Like they, first it's the British Empire, then it's the U.S.,
Actually they sucked Italy dry, and they also sucked the European banking system dry. There isn't immense publicity, but I think that Belgium was sucked dry, and I think Italy was, and basically during the time of the Renaissance by the banking families, yeah. And then moved into Britain. Britain was the world empire. It was the Masonic head, you know, East Trading Company. But then the world wars basically. You know, they had to suck all of the resources out of it at that time. And so that after World War II, then they moved to the United States. And, you know, we have been their host for the parasite for the last, you know, 70 years. Mm-hmm. But as you can see by our $22 trillion debt, and it's actually far worse than that because, you know, bear in mind the $5 trillion Federal Reserve balance sheet is mm-hmm. something it should be by any sane accounting standards be put into the debt system. And then you have the unfunded liabilities. Well, don't even think about
yes,
this.
These that's numbers just...
are numbers that are too big for human even to grasp. I mean, anyway, so, I mean, the system is shot. There's just no way that the debt can be serviced by this economy. There is a lot of really extraordinary talent and wealth creation functions inside the United States. I mean, all these technical companies.
Yeah.
But the problem is one, there just isn't enough of them to fund debt of this size. And two, so many of them international now. You know, you look at Apple manufacturing the iPhones in China, using the Irish banking system to, you know, to keep its capital tax-free from U.S., you know. So our economy is actually far weaker, you know, than even people realize. And when the collapse occurs, it's going to be much faster than, say, Britain, you know, which probably, you know, had a twilight of like 20 or 30 years. I mean, Jim, this is just going to faceplant. You're just going to wake up one Monday morning and the system will have frozen up and then it just won't get unstuck. What do you think, a lot of people feel that the system will simply shut down and then all of the savings that people think they have will just disappear. The banks will simply, you know, become non-existent. The internet access to capital will also disappear. I mean, that is a real possibility in the alchemy based world, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and then you have some sort of deflationary collapse. All things being equal, you might get some regenerative process. The only problem is you have these parasites unwilling to take the haircut. So they're going to make sure that, you know, that they keep their vast wealth while everyone starves to death. That's what happened, you know. And often these crises are perpetrated to concentrate wealth. I mean, that's,
yeah,
you know.
Well, the people on the inside will be obviously aware that this is going to occur, and they'll have already made preparations. I mean, they'll basically be short the market. And so to whatever extent financial transactions are generating profit, they'll be winning all of those bets. But mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a lot worse than that. I think that the system just doesn't get up. I mean, as I understand the derivative situation, and this again, because it's just one of these black boxes, just like, you know, trying to audit the Fed. But as I understand the derivative situation, the idea that there is a balance is, you know, that the counterparty risks are somehow balanced out so that, you know, you can just walk away from this this situation with at least one entity being intact. I just don't believe this. I think that the way these derivative contracts are created, there is, you know, risk everywhere inside the system. And no one will know who has solvent and who is not when the thing blows up. And we're just going to have basically a banking system that will take a long time. What's going to happen is this. In other words, when Lehman was an AIG, when they were basically in the point of collapse, the problem is that the debt was inside the system and no one knew where it was. So no one could really understand who was solvent. When you have these derivatives and they're all daisy chained out and all the companies are involved in them, if something like Lehman had failed, Lehman had about $1 trillion in derivatives, I believe. It was close to $1 trillion, maybe $800 billion. But no one knew exactly what that debt meant to the whole system. In other words, the banks loan money to one another, and it's based upon the trust that, you know, bank A is going to be in existence at the end of the day. But if you have derivatives which are not, you know, which you know have blown up, but no one knows who owns them, who holds them, who owes what to whom, you can't be sure that if you loan money to bank A, it's going to be in existence at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And what happens then is the interbank lending, which is the beating heart of the mm-hmm. American financial system, simply would come to a stop. And this was why when Paulson went into Bush's office and he said, "I need $800 billion, Bush just wrote the check because, or issued the credit, because they knew that the interbank system, the lending system, was going to stop. And if it had stopped even for a second, the system would just faceplant. And this is what I believe is going to happen. Because if it happens again, if you have, you know, a large entity suddenly become insolvent, the numbers are too big now. The derivative world is so much bigger now than it was in 08 that you could need not just $800 billion, but you could need like $10 trillion or something to backstop the whole thing. And that would be too big a number for the people who are concerned about the solvency of the dollar and the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. You know, we just couldn't create $10 trillion in debt in a single day and think the currency would survive that. So we're just in a rock and a hard place. And then if the system doesn't come back to life, in other words, if the banks are frozen up and the derivative world starts getting daisy chained out, and you start having these all these different entities are no longer seen as solvent. They're all looked at as potential demons. Well, how long will it take to get the system going? I don't think that the system will ever come back, and I think that you'll have basically just a complete wipeout of the wealth of the savings of the American people. Because basically all of this ends up with the dollar. I mean, what would the dollar be worth under those conditions? You know, the alchemy would be exposed, Tim.
Yeah.
Just as you say, it's an alchemy-based system. And if that alchemy is exposed, if people think it's they're dealing with magic. Griffin, who you know, had studied the Federal Reserve and wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island, he coined the phrase the Mandrake effect. Mm-hmm. Because he said, you know, there's just so much hocus pocus and magic in how they, you know, create the money and how they fool the public. Well, that's what I think that I'm in agreement. I'm in agreement with your expression, alchemy-based economy, and I'm in agreement with the idea that it's Mandrake, which, you know, the idea of Mandrake the musician. It's just an illusion, dude, and if it blows up...
the crisis will be a pretext to impose a world currency.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And see, then they'll just like they they went from, you know, Italy to Belgium to Britain and then to the United States. And the next iteration will be world currency.
I mean, something like, you know, it's special drawing rights with the system where they have with this basket of currencies and already including, you know, the yuan into it. And the Americans may still have dollars, but the dollars will buy a lot less, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they'll blame somebody else. They'll blame, like anything when you have inflation, they'll blame the shop owners, you know.
Well, there's going to be see, what will happen is that they will have to just basically create tons of money. $100 trillion. Yeah. Who knows? You know what would be the amount? And this will just crush the dollar. The dollar could be worth, you know, 1/20th or 1/100th of what it is now. But there'll be lots of them, and you'll be poor, but you'll have an access to some dollars. The money in your account will be available. It just won't be able to buy much.
I think the essential point is you can be turned into Argentina overnight by just a decision taken by some elite banksters. Yeah. And the essential point is here is how insecure you think you have money, you think you have property. You don't. It's nothing. You don't own. They own it all because they control the money, and they created a system to control the creation of money to create this very situation we're in, because they want everyone on a precipice of disaster. It's shock doctrine. It's these things. It's anxiety, and occasionally they'll benefit off collapsing the banking system. And that's what they do. That's why they've created a global banking system to begin with. And that's what H.G. Wells wrote about this, creating a global system of credit and money for the very purposes of creating an empire and controlling it, and ultimately for depopulation. So you're wondering why they're doing it. You think it's just insane. Well, no, there's a plan to it. There's a reason for it. I mean, why would you create a system so overextension? Why do this unless you're expecting some sort of reduction of the herd?
Well, they're doing it to benefit themselves.
Yeah.
And, basically we're dealing with a malevolent secret society that has population reduction as its primary goal. Mm-hmm. And so when you see like a World War I and you can't figure it out, well, try to plug in the idea that this is population reduction. You sent me an internet link. It was about a book now that has been written by a member of Skull and Bones.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't say he's Skull and Bones, but...
Well, but anyway, I think he did, actually. I think in the... He says that he was a member of Skull and Bones, but that... He didn't mention who his name was, it's like the book's entitled Skull and Keys: The Hidden History of Yale Secret Society. Oh, I see. You're right. Maybe he doesn't. No. He actually identifies himself and it says he's a member of Skull and Bones. But anyway, the point I wanted to make was that the book talks about the participation of Skull and Bones in the Civil War.
Yeah, it was interesting.
and it points out that that Jefferson Davis, right, had his closest advisor John Perkins as a member of Skull and Bones, and that,
that's Perkins from the opium trade, right?
Exactly, same guy. So you have the all right. So now you've got the East Trading Company involved here. And then you have, Russell, who was the one of the founders of the Skull and Bones, was very close friends and advisor to John Brown.
Yes.
Right. Now, in fact, he was one of the trustees of John Brown's will. Now, that is truly amazing. and now it gets... Now finally the fact is very the fun that really made it, you know, I think makes it clear to people is that Davis was Jefferson Davis was captured he was tried for treason, but the prosecutor released him from Union custody, and the prosecutor amazingly was a Skull and Bone member. Both sides of the dialectic, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the point is that little chain of data you know, of Jefferson Davis and John Perkins and John Brown, and you've got all of the Confederate skull and bones people leading you right off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And when Davis is caught, he gets released from Union custody because the prosecutor was also a Skull and Bones member. Now, when you think about how few people are in Skull and Bones, this is 1940, for God's sake, 1865.
Yeah.
When Davis was captured, when Jefferson Davis was captured, he points out that he was captured with two Skull and Bones members. Right, these are his advisors. The whole thing, he says, this is like the Kennedy assassination, Tim. There's yes. nothing but Skull and Bones members everywhere. You know, they're all these Skull and Bones guys. Now, okay, but then Davis gets released, and the prosecutor was a Skull and Bones member. This is that's the critical point, because it shows you that they're on both sides, that the whole thing's fake, that the war was just a way to kill a bunch of Irish Catholics, basically.
Yeah, yes. You know,
this
yes.
is and to get rid of a lot of wealth that and people that weren't inside the guild. It was a Skull and Bones maneuver. They got involved with the political forces on both sides. They created a Confederacy, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they had the political structure aligned right, then they ran the armies into each other and killed a bunch of people.
Yeah, and they're paying for John Brown's black op, you know, down there.
Yeah, exactly.
Stir up in Kansas.
Stir it up, you know, get the motion going. Well, I don't mean to be long-winded, but the point is, okay, that's how you should be looking at the banking system. And when you just went through like the thing, well, like, why are they doing this? What is the long-term goal? Long-term goal is population reduction, totalitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically creating a one world, a new world order where there'll be a one world currency,
and
that's where we're headed.
And ultimately, you need financial weapons to achieve that, to get the resources and things. You know.
Yeah, I mean, well, they can't do it without access to capital, to money. They don't. The way they get it is to basically just to create out of thin air. They control the financial system, political system, so they can manufacture this wealth. Use it to create the technology to enslave people, to reduce population. And then when the next step is pretty, you can see in the future where the banking system is taking us, it's going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And now when it fails, martial law, how does the food supply, who's going to control it? Well, I think the government will control it, them. And I think you're just going to have a holodomor on a large scale, you know, in the United States, you know, that's what I'm afraid of.
I was reading a book, John Hamer's book, Behind the Curtain, a chilling expose of the banking system. And he begins with a case, a legal case. I'll read it to describes the basic fraudulent nature of the banking system, particularly how loans create money, how when a bank makes a loan, it actually creates the money. It's not loaning out money it's saved or is saving for somebody. It actually creates money, and then it collects interest on it and gets the principal back. And just how fundamentally fraudulent that is. And how contrary it is to all sense of justice and normal accounting and idea of finance and the economy. But he cites a case in 1968. He goes, in December 1968 saw a landmark court case in the appropriately named township of Credit River, Minnesota, USA. First National Bank of Montgomery versus Daley was an epic courtroom drama, and although unsurprisingly not widely reported either at the time or subsequently, it is actually extremely significant. Jerome Daley, a lawyer by profession, defended himself against the bank's attempted foreclosure on his $14,000 mortgage on the grounds that there was no consideration for the loan. Consideration in legalese refers to the items exchanged as an essential element of any legal contract. Daley contended the bank offered no consideration for his loan on the grounds that they had created the money out of thin air by bookkeeping entry and had therefore not suffered a loss, another relevant point of law, by his refusal or inability to pay back the money. The proceedings were recorded by Justice William Drexler, who had given no credence whatsoever to the defense until Mr. Morgan, that's a funny name for a bank owner, Mr. Morgan, the bank's president, took to the witness stand. To Drexler's and indeed everyone else's present Evanel's presence a great surprise, Morgan casually admitted under questioning from Daly's lawyer that the bank routinely created money out of thin air for all its loans and the mortgages, and this indeed was standard practice in all banks. Presiding Justice Martin Mahoney declared, "It sounds like fraud to me," accompanied by nods of murmurs of assent from all around the courtroom. In a summation of the case, Judge Mahoney reported that plaintiff, the bank, admitted that it, in combination with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, did create the entire $14,000 in money and credit upon its own books by bookkeeping entry, that this was the consideration used to support the note dated May 8, 1964, and the mortgage of the same date. The money and the credit first came into existence when they created it. Morgan admitted that no United States law or statute existed which gave him the right to do this. A lawful consideration must exist and be tendered to support the note. So the court duly rejected the bank's claim for the foreclosure, and the defendant kept his house. The implications of this case, therefore, should have been far-reaching. If bankers are indeed extending credit without consideration, which they most definitely are, i.e., without backing their loans with the real money they actually have stored in their vaults and were entitled to lend, any judicial decision declaring their loans void would topple the entire world financial and banking system. Jerome Daly subsequently wrote in a local news article, "The decision, which is legally sound, has the effect of declaring all private mortgages on real and personal property and all U.S. and state bonds held by the Federal Reserve, national state banks, to be null and void. This amounts to an emancipation of this nation from personal, national, and state debt reportedly owed to this banking system. Every American owes it to himself to study this decision very carefully, for upon it hangs the question of freedom or slavery." Perhaps needless to say, the decision utterly failed to change the prevailing practice, even though it was never legally challenged or overruled. Justice Mahoney actually threatened to prosecute and expose the bank as a result. Somewhat unsurprisingly, he died less than 6 months after the Daly trial in an extremely suspicious boating accident, and the subsequent autopsy revealed his body to have been full of some unspecified kind of poison. Beware anyone who stands in the way of these people and the nefarious practices. Since the precedent, many other defendants have attempted to have mortgages and loans nullified using the same defense as Daly, but there have been extremely limited success, only in the fact that one judge said, strictly off the record, "If I let you do that, you and everyone else, it would bring the whole banking system down. I cannot let you go behind the bar of the bank. We will not go behind that curtain."
Hilarious.
So
yeah, well, that's a great. I was unaware of that decision, but first it was completely accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And the logic is just uncontestable. And they're right; the banking system would collapse. However, the beneficiary would be the nation.
Mm-hmm.
We would be free of this parasitical illegal usury that we are subjected to every single day, and our nation would flourish. So this, one of the things that I'm often, talking about is, what is the target of the alternative media? I mean, what can we do? You know, we come to some understanding, and we know that, we're in real trouble. We know we're under attack. So how do we respond? Well, here's a target. This is the easiest target to get at is the banking system. And this is where I would like to see everyone just focus their efforts. Just go after the banks. Just try to get people to understand that the system is parasitical. It's illegal. And they shouldn't have to pay any debt. Just end this.
We need a jubilee. The Bible.
We need a jubilee. An interest jubilee. Right.
Yeah. And a lot of that is just like a lot of criminal institutions that we live under. I mean, we inherit them, we just accept them. You've probably experienced this if you've talked about the criminal financial system or the crimes of the Pentagon and the Empire. People will just roll their eyes. They don't want to. They can't. It's either they're overwhelmed by it, or they're beguiled by it. They don't want to consider it because it upsets their worldview. Their understanding of things. Look at the role, again, the financial system. We haven't even touched on the role that narcotics trafficking plays in this.
Yeah.
And how the narcotics not only probably monetize much as the of the U.S. debt, buys U.S. government bonds, but it keeps Wall Street afloat. It funds a lot of these corporate mergers, like the famous RJR Nabisco merger in the 80s was funded by narcotics trafficking, laundered through cigarette sales in Eastern Europe. These huge, huge things. And a lot of the corporate concentration that we're experiencing today, the destruction of small to mid-sized companies, the destruction of local businesses, is being fueled, or the capital for that is the international drug trade. And now that Catherine Austin
Fitz. Well, they need it to create liquidity. Banks oftentimes don't have any money. Everything is loaned out. It's all ledger main. The deposits are long gone. Where is their actual cash? They've got reserves all over the world, but no actual cash. Well, the money comes from the drugs.
Well, this is where the people are their own enemy. Because they don't want to unplug from a system which is destroying them, the tapeworm economy.
Yeah.
Catherine Austin Fitz tells a story where she was giving an address to an audience of about 100 people who she generally considers more aware than the typical public. And she spelled out the role narcotics trafficking plays in inflating the values of their 401ks. Because they're invested in corporations where the drug money is laundered. Now, how it's laundered, it's pretty simple. If you're, KFC or Burger King or McDonald's or a chain, something like that, a local drug dealer will use that business to funnel, to launder the money. Ultimately, these corporations are publicly traded, and people own these corporations in their 401ks, and this keeps the stock value high. And if earning to values ratio in these things. So if you're, if you have $100,000 being pumped into a business, that will raise the stock value by $1 million roughly. And so it's keeping everyone rich. But at the same time, these drugs are destroying the communities in which they live. And she has this thing called the Solari Index, or the Popsicle Index, is how if you look at the people's personal debt and their standard of living, or their living, their quality of life has gone down as the Dow Jones Industrial Average has gone up. And there's a connection there, because a lot of this is related to the drug trade. And what she talks about, she explained this, and she said, "Now, if I were able to press this button and stop the sale of drugs in your community, but it would cause your 401ks to the value to plummet, would you do it?" And out of 100 people, only one said yes.
Yeah, the drug. This huge lump of liquidity, I think, really is basically the industry that keeps interbank lending in America basic existence. But there are new
the narco dollar is as important as the petrodollar.
Yes, the narco dollar. The Swiss Central Bank has been buying stocks. Swiss stocks and also international stocks, but a lot of Swiss stocks. Now, where does it get the money? It doesn't use money, it just invents it. So this is a real, talk about totalitarian. You have a private bank, because the Swiss Central Bank has the same provenance that the U.S. Federal Reserve does, is using its power to create credit simply for the purpose of buying stocks for itself. It becomes the owner. They put these things as assets, which, and people are not up in arms, even though this is going to end up with the central bank being the only shareholder owner in Switzerland at some point in the future, because right now their share values are through the roof, right?
Yeah, because they're buying. Yeah, because they're buying.
We're all benefiting from the idea that. Well, let me tell you something. You don't benefit when you are in competition for the ownership of a corporation with an entity that can vent capital.
No.
This power is the genie. It's the alchemy. And if you don't put this back into the bottle, you will have no freedom. There will be no democracy in this world. There will simply be the banking families and whoever they are and whatever they are, that group will rule this world.
And everyone will be working at an Amazon distribution center or Walmart.
those that are alive. But I mean, yeah. I don't really think, you know, there's, to my mind, you know, the Georgia Guidestones were not created cheap. I mean, I don't know if you ever studied them, but a lot of money went into the creation of that monument. And it talks about, I don't know, 500 or 400 million people. Mm-hmm. It's 1/10 of the population, meaning that, you know, 90% is going to have to die to get to where it wants to take the planet. And I think that's what's going to happen. I think that this is, and the banking system, the one we're suffering from, is really the arrow's tip, because that's really what's going to create the financial chaos that will create the martial law, which will then start the onset of the real population reduction. You know, you look at World War I, the Civil War, the 30 Years War, World War II, the Vietnam War. Tim, we haven't seen anything. In my opinion, the genocide in the future is going to make the rest of this stuff look, you know, banal, trivial. You know, to get to the population numbers they want, you're going to have to lose a whole bunch of people. So I think we should be trying to organize ourselves, trying to get understanding of our world, you know, as quickly as we can, and share information and try to find some way to resist, because I don't think the plans that they have are hard to understand, and I really don't think they're that far away.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And if there is a general crisis, don't support any plan to centralize and these things, and don't panically run to a new world currency, because it immediately buys you something. That's how they get you desperate, and they get you roped into a system. It's like running into a FEMA camp or something, because they're offering you food or something.
Exactly. But you know, the thing is the people are so unprepared at this point. It's hard to really know what to do. Because, you know, for the vast majority of people, they just don't have any. They are completely dependent upon the banking system. They don't even know it, but the banking system is basically what feeds them, what keeps them alive. It's the alchemy.
Yep. They're addicted to it, and you get it. You know, it's like being a heroin addict or something. You crave it. You crave the very thing that's destroying you. There's an interesting, several years ago, I was watching a Ken Burns series on Prohibition, and he talked about, there's a convention in Atlantic City, I think in 1928 or 1929, where the various bootleggers, gangsters, met to try to organize and cartelize or rationalize their business, and they were going to break it up into various regions, and the model they wanted to follow was the 12 regions of the Federal Reserve System. Well, that's appropriate.
Sure.
Why not?
Sure. No, it's a good model to follow for criminals. But, you know, we need to recognize that the alchemy is going to be done away with at some point. And then what will we have left? We need to start creating some political power, you know. And the one thing that I hope, you know, doesn't occur is this whole idea about, you know, prepping and bug out. You know, you're not going to go into the forest and live off of deer and, you know, natural plants and things. I mean, believe me, all that, there'll be so many hungry people wandering around, it's just not going to make any sense. What we really need to do is to stand and fight right now. And people who have the understanding that would enable them to be preppers, they're the ones that really should have the responsibility of going into the public and trying to raise political awareness.
Awareness is the big thing here, because the world has such immense wealth and wealth potential. If you get out of this system, people can live far better and support far many people. So there's all this fear about overpopulation. That's just an excuse for genocide. But exactly. I mean, you're getting out of the system. I mentioned the Jubilee, a relief from the system, which historically people understood. People understood the idea of unsustainable debt. It's too much. We got to let it go. I think every 7 years was in the Bible or something. We're going on 75, 80 years.
Yeah, you know, where's our jubilee?
Yeah, and I mean, look at the past. I mean, even the 19th century, where you have like the these. It wasn't perfect, but you had the banking system was highly decentralized. As a result, whenever there was a panic, the panics were kept local, and it was, and also because bankers couldn't get away with too much lending, they were more disciplined in their lending. And you had growth. You had real economic growth. You had non-inflationary growth. You don't need inflation for economic growth. But again, ever since the 20th century, we've equated, we need, you know, the Fed has to, heat up the economy, cool down the economy, all this, you know, the new economics of the 1960s, all this Keynesianism, which is just an excuse to rob people, and an excuse for militarism. It was, you know, obviously someone like Keynes who told them, gave politicians an excuse to print a bunch of money and spend it. Yeah, we liked that idea.
Of course.
Let's do it. Of course, in the end, when he was confronted with the contradiction of his own theories, he said, well, in the end, we're all dead anyway.
Yeah, thanks a lot, John Maynard. I mean, you know, he's just a Masonic cesspool. I mean, he basically was part of the Bentham, you know, Adam Smith group that was coming up with a rationale for slavery.
And a contempt for posterity. I mean, because obviously we're not all dead. We have children. We have grandchildren. Exactly. We care about that. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it was just absurd. So, you know, so this is just part of the philosophy of the group that we can see what they were like by the Irish bust. You know, this is a really good indicator of what Palmerston and Bentham and Adam Smith and Keynes really were. Was they were organized into this Masonic genocide program. And unfortunately, when you look at the Federal Reserve System, you're just seeing another aspect of it. So, you know, hopefully this is helping people build out the schematic a little bit. This is just another thing that is part of our demise. So we need to start thinking of ways to replace the Federal Reserve System. Mm-hmm. It comes first with exposure. People have to start realizing that the usury that we're subjected to is illegal, it's immoral, and it's, you know, it's just being done for no real economic purpose other than to enrich a very tiny minority at the expense of the entire rest of the population.
Yeah, a system of legalized plunder.
Yeah, we're all suffering from the criminal interest debt structure that we. I mean, you know, you get a 30-year mortgage on a house.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And they're paying three times what it costs.
The interest is like three times the principal.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's absolutely, totally crazy. And so, you know, let's not put up with it, folks. Let's fight to the end here. Let's get rid of that. I mean, if we could just get the population to realize that the interest should be something that is only owned by the people. That the people's government is the only thing that can own any benefit of interest, because we create the capital out of our faith and credit in us. Mm-hmm. The ones whose currency is debased by the creation of capital, so we're the ones that should benefit. No private corporation should be benefiting from the creation of money out of thin air. The only people that should benefit from that should be the public in general. And if we did that, we would reduce, I mean, there's different estimates, but I think you'd reduce the interest by, you could reduce it down by 90% of what it is today. And now all of that money that is not going into the banking cartel's coffers, where does it go? It's directly into the public. Because you see, that's money that we wouldn't be spending. Those are interest payments that wouldn't have to be made. Those are credit card payments that wouldn't have to be made. Those are car loans. I mean, all of that capital becomes the you talk about, you know, the need to incentivize the economy to, you know, to create economic. Think about what that would do. The direct infusion of capital into the communities that would no longer be bearing the burden of that kind of debt. It would create economic, you know, revival in the United States.
Yeah, and of course, with a stable currency and without inflation and interest, all these things that we think we need loans for, we would need loans because they'd be that much cheaper.
Exactly. Yeah. So there it is, brother. So, I think we laid it out for them pretty clearly here.
Okay, Joe. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Being tight.
Good talking to you, and we'll talk next week.
Talk next week. Take care. Have a nice weekend.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.